Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for coming out on another hot, hot day in Phoenix. But by now, I think we're all used to it. And thank you, virtual audience, for joining us. I'm very pleased that Mark Pryor got up at 5:30 this morning in Austin, Texas, in order to get here to Phoenix so he could spend time with you all. So, was it four?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
It's fine. It's all the same at that point.
I was trying to make it slightly less horrible. In any case, I'm very pleased to see you again.
Wonderful to be here. And I honestly don't mind getting up to come out here. This is one of my favorite trips of the year. So,
well,
lovely to be here.
That's lovely. We went to the Royal Palms for lunch. My husband had told me that the French fries were a killer, and he was absolutely correct. So, if you like French fries, I can recommend both the Ballyhoe and the Royal Palms for excellent fries.
Agree.
Right, which I only started eating when I became lactose intolerant, and it's the one safe thing I can order, French fries and ketchup. No dairy, so it's wonderful. Anyway, and it's very French, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Pomfrit.
Yeah. Right. Any of you remember that wonderful series with the Michelin Guide detective? I'm trying to think of his name. It went on forever. And he had a dog called Pomfrit that went with him everywhere. I'll have to look him up. It was a really long-running series. And unsurprisingly, because he was the Michelin restaurant guide, it tended to penetrate restaurants in France, where apparently a lot of wrongdoing went on.
Yeah, but think about the fun research for those books.
It really was.
Wow, that would be great.
I know.
I like
yeah.
that.
I love it. But in any case, we are, and many of you are here, or in fact, all of you here, probably had read the Hugo Marston books. Am I right? Right. And so a first question for Mark will be, we discussed it at lunch, is there any hope that you might be writing another Hugo Marston?
There is hope. I just finished the third book in the Henri of the Henri books. And this was last weekend, and I was at home, and I didn't have anything to write, and so I was kind of bouncing around the house, and my wife basically said to me, look, either you can go start a new Hugo book, or you can help with the chores. So I went to my favorite library and was noodling a new Hugo book, and I'm thinking about setting it in and maybe like a chocolate factory.
How wonderful. I could, you know, another place I could recommend to you, because I've been there myself, is the Baccarat. There's an actual, I thought it was just a firm name, but Baccarat is actually the name of a village in France where they make all the glass. And I have a great story. You want to hear it?
I was just thinking about somebody dying in blown glass, but yes, I do.
You could do that. So if you're a tourist in France, one of the things you have to remember is the French take lunch really seriously. So things are open for you as a tourist, for example, a chateau, or let's say Baccarat, from 10 or sometimes 10:30 till 12:15, or if you're lucky, 12:30, whereupon it closes and you can't get back in again till sometime after 2. It's really rigid. So my husband and I were driving along, and a village sign came up and it said Baccarat, and I thought, oh, that can't be. And then I thought, wow, I wonder if it actually is. So we zoomed off. It's now 12 o'clock, and we're approaching the village, and there's a museum. There's the factory and the hall bit, but there's a gorgeous museum. And I thought, I try never to miss a museum. I thought, we'll try it. So as we get there, they're closing, and people are coming out. So I did. I put on my poor little me mask and rushed up, and in my broken French, I said to them that, you know, here we were just passing by. It would be our only chance ever if we could just have 15 minutes in the museum. And they said, well, madam, you can't see anything in 15 minutes. I said, actually, I can. I said,
professional museum going.
Absolutely. I said, you have no idea how well I can go 15 minutes. So, in fact, they let us in, didn't even charge, which is really unusual. And we did the whole thing. And as we came out, it was like 12:23. And we're walking down the hill, and there is a museum store. And I lit up. And Rob, in a desperate moment, said to me, now they'll be closed. But in fact, somebody came out in the pavement and saw us coming. So they held the door, and we went in. And he eventually bought me this gorgeous Baccarat necklace, which I wear sometimes as this beautiful piece of glass and a silver thing. And if you're going to buy it, you want to ship it, because otherwise you have to pay the 15 cent, you know, the 15%, whatever it all is. So we arranged all that. We managed to get that done in 12 minutes. And off we went. And some weeks later, I got a call from FedEx in Atlanta, and they said, "We have what appears to be a valuable silver artifact from France for you, and we have no idea what to charge you for customs." And I realized that they thought the glass was a big chunk of silver, and they were prepared to charge me, you know, like thousands of dollars and all. And I said to them, "It's just glass." They went, "Oh, okay." And eventually sent it to me. So, you know, it was a complicated adventure, but maybe we could do something with it.
Yeah, that sounds fun. I'm open to anything and everything.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. So you go just in the natal stages, but let's talk for a moment about Die Around Sundown, which is the first Henri Lefort.
Yes. Henri was conceived right before COVID. And fortunately for me, because I wrote the story and it's in two different, it's First World War and Second World War. And I had the timelines very distinct in the initial manuscript. And then I sent it to my agent and she's like, "Love the story, doesn't work like this." And so COVID was hitting, my creativity took a nosedive, except I was able to edit something I'd already written. So fortunately, the final version, you know me, but I write very quickly and I write it and then I'm done with it and move on. But that's the only book I've taken like 2 years to work on. And yeah, it features Henri Lefort, who is a detective in Paris, 1940. And the first book, he's assigned to investigate the murder of a Nazi in the Louvre Museum, which is something of a struggle for him because one extra dead Nazi is a good thing, right? I think we all agree still that that's the case. But he has to do his job, and that's one of the themes that runs through the first two books is no matter who dies, no matter how they die, even if maybe they should, he still has to do his job.
So Henri was served in the First World War, right?
Yes, yes.
And does that come into play in terms of how he does his job? Well, let's not go there. He's come out of the First World War, and did he join the police right away?
And we're not going there because there's a very major plot point that revolves around him in the First World War. So, I'm sorry, what was the question?
Which I've already given away, unfortunately, in the write-up, I apologize. But anyway, assuming you haven't read my write-up, you will wonder what is going on with Henri. And he lives with his sister.
Yes, also... Yes, I guess we're going to assume everyone's read the first one.
No, but...
Oh, and if you... okay, good. Everyone's read the first one. Everyone here has read the first
everybody,
one.
Not everybody watching.
If you haven't, then ignore that question. He lives with a young lady who actually is... She's there. Her name is Nicola. And for anybody who knows me personally, they know that I have three children, a son called Henri, and his younger sister called Nicola. And as you will remember, they did not get along, probably. For many, many years, they would butt heads and fight each other and thump each other. So I thought, well, how fun to make them live in the same apartment, just to mess with them. Fortunately, they get on much better now. If you read my Hugo series, you know that I like having strong, intelligent women in the books. And one of my problems with writing this series that I hadn't realized that I would come across is that in her historical fiction, it's actually quite hard to have strong, intelligent, powerful, influential women. Just because all of the jobs, you didn't have female detectives. You didn't have female captains of industry. The women were housewives or...
Well, but you could have them, but they weren't working. They were, you know, they were strong, intelligent women at home or in social circles rather than professional circles.
Definitely. And yeah, it was just something that I hadn't thought about going into writing a historical series, that they would be harder to find. And luckily for me, doing research, I came across Princess Marie Bonaparte. Just really, shame to say it, initially on Wikipedia. And then I got a copy of her biography and thought, wow, this is an incredible human being that needs to be in the book.
So Henri actually meets, in the first book, Princess Marie, there's a robbery, if I remember right, and he's called to the scene.
Yes, he actually ends up arguably saving her life and becoming a little bit of a celebrity hero momentarily for that. But more importantly, she kind of gets her hooks into him because she knows, she can see there's something wrong with him, something broken in him. And the true story with her is that she was fascinated by, then a student of, then a friend of, and then helped Sigmund Freud escape Austria and into England. And so she was always very big into what they then called psychoanalysis, became a practitioner of it in real life. And to me, this was like the perfect mechanism for the reader to kind of get to know Henri and explore his many, many issues. You know, from his trauma as a child, First World War stuff, to tell that story, and then to diagnose him with this condition he has, misophonia.
So the Nazis have already occupied Paris.
They just strolled in.
Hardly strolled. They rolled in. But,
rolled in.
Okay. But Princess Marie, I mean, did they give her kind of a pass because she, you know, why didn't she flee?
Historically, I don't. The problem I have with research is that I soon forget it and then I change it. So, for example, I know it's terrible, people, and somebody's going to trip me up on this. I know it. Somebody's going to read that book and be like, "Well, actually, Picasso was not in Paris on that particular date," and my response to that will be, "I don't care." You know, and so with Marie, Mimi, as we call her in the book, I don't even remember if that was her real nickname either. Benefits of old age, you forget things and then you don't care that you've forgotten things. But I think generally the from the research I did, my impression is the way it worked in when the Germans first got there was they weren't super oppressive except to some people. Like they wanted to maintain this aura of, no, we're the benign invaders and we're going to be nice to you, and yeah, we're going to eat all your food and you're not going to have any food, but we'll be polite to you in the street. And so to people like her, who has privilege and money and connections, yeah, they're going to be nicer to her than they are to some shopkeeper. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, despite all the things that they did that were terrible, they didn't actually destroy a lot of Paris. And with great luck, jumping ahead, when they left, they didn't blow it up, which everybody feared that they would, but they didn't, or we would not have, you know, the Paris that we know today.
Yeah, and that's, you know, people often ask me, why do I set my books in Paris? And it's because I love the city, and one of the reasons I love the city, it's one of the few cities in Europe that's the same, essentially the same today as it was 100 years ago, or even just pre-war.
I think the Franco-Prussian War did more damage to Paris than the Nazis did.
Yeah, and, you know, the Nazis, they valued Paris. They had that. I can't remember what the policy was, that every soldier got to have a trip to Paris, got to have one vacation in Paris, because they valued the Paris as it was. So I have to think that's why there was some reluctance to explode it on the way in and on the way out.
I think actually Hitler had ordered it destroyed, and the guy that was in charge ignored him. By the time the order, if I remember this right, that the whoever the commandant was in charge of Paris overruled Hitler. And
good for him.
Yeah, exactly. well, by then, I think it was fairly clear that Hitler was on his way out and it wouldn't be so dangerous to ignore, you know, his order. So we'll see. Anyway, we're fortunate that Paris survived. But we're in 1940 and Die Around Sunset. Where have we progressed to in the dark edge of night?
Well, I'm wanting this to be a long-lasting series, and I want to write it chronologically, so we're not very far along, time-wise.
That's the great thing about historical fiction. You can start the next case the day after one. Nobody's asking you to age it in real time.
I know. I don't want to, because I don't want to run out of World War II, which is a phrase nobody ever said before.
No, that's not true, because I've talked to other authors like Rhys Bowen, who doesn't want to get to the war. So she's creeping her way through the 1930s. So she doesn't have to get into World War II, because then it would be, it's like people who are writing Edwardian age, you know, they all want to stop in like 1913 because, you know, it's gone. When we get to August of 1914, that whole beautiful Gilded Age, you know, goes away.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
So you want to creep your story along unless you want to run out of
Yeah. So this is the first book is 1940. The second one happens, I think, right before Christmas. And so the third one, which, like I say, I've just finished, is New Year's Eve. So I'm thinking I can get like a 6 books a year in and make it last another 4 years. So yeah, I'm being optimistic, maybe.
Henri's going to be fairly exhausted if he just managed to get, got to Christmas and now it's New Year's Eve and yet another crime. Well, but the thing is that under the occupation, there would have been a constant stream of crime. So, you know, it wouldn't be so improbable that he would finish a case around Christmas and then get another one by New Year's Eve.
That's true, although I have this sort of juxtaposition of a lot of the people who commit crimes are young men, but a lot of them were no longer in Paris, right, because of the Germans shipping them off or they were at war or whatever. But on the other hand, there were fewer detectives too. So he's in the one I've just finished, there's a murder right outside his building. And because he was drunk and sleeping, he didn't hear anything. So his boss is like, well, in that case, you can investigate it, even though it's outside his building. So, I think I can have as many crimes as I want and have.
I mean, actually, wartime policing is a really an interesting subject. Years ago, I'm trying to remember the author's name, a book called Blackout, wonderful book. And it is about a policeman in London trying to be a policeman in London during the war. For some reason, might have been an injury or something, he is not serving, you know, in the army. And so he is performing as a cop, and how really difficult that was. And people would come up to him and, you know, harass him about why he wasn't in the service. I don't remember what kind of injury he had and all. But, you know, that was true. I think somebody else wrote a really good book about Detroit during the war and how there weren't enough people to be cops or anything, you know, because they were either working on the assembly lines because Detroit was a major manufacturer for the war, or they were off in Europe. And so the criminals, such as there were, could run amok.
Yeah. And for Henri, it's even more difficult because the normal chain of command has kind of been extended or bifurcated because he has his boss. But especially when he's investigating the murder of a German, then he has to report to the Germans too. And they are considerably less patient. And so, yeah, that just makes it even more complicated.
I just remembered his name.
Who was it?
John Lawton, Lawton, a book called Blackout. Proving once again that just because you're old, your memory doesn't fail you. It just takes longer to access whatever memory it is.
I'm relieved to hear that.
No, it's true. You know, well, you're all used to me not being able to recall titles and stuff, but it is. I've always remembered it because I thought that was such a topic we don't think about all that much. You know, if all the men are off fighting and, you know, most of the women who are able to are working and all, who's looking after everybody else? Well, whatever criminals there are, many of whom might be juveniles, actually, rather, because not old enough to serve or something, are running crazy in the streets. And yeah. I mean, it's a major wartime problem that we don't tend to think about.
Yeah, and a lot of the younger cops that are involved with Henri, I mean, he notes two or three in the first couple books that they look like they're children. Like they're just that, you know, did you decide to come to police station instead of elementary school today just because they look so young?
All right. So what is happening, the instigating incident here? You've already sort of mentioned it, but you have to look it up to remember it.
Not at all. No, I just it's refreshing my recollection. It's crazy how you forget what you write. So this is a missing persons case initially, but there's also a body that's found in an apartment that is not clear whether it was natural death, whether it was robbery, whether it was murder, and there is also an element of disappearing children, and the women in his life, Nicola and Mimi, are very concerned about this because the women of Paris are coming to them saying, you know, you have power, you know, cops, can you investigate these missing kids? And Henri is being told by these Germans, no, you have to find this missing Nazi. And then his boss is saying, no, you have to solve this murder. And so he's telling his, you know, the women that are the most important to him in his life, just, you know, take a back seat. I'm sure everything's fine. Of course, everything's not fine. And the stories end up kind of winding together.
Who's the missing German?
The missing German is a doctor who has recently arrived from Germany and is taking, is one of three doctors who is leading a particular research program at a hospital in Paris. More than that, I should not say.
No, you really shouldn't. Talk to us a little bit about Rennes, because Rennes, R-E-N-N-E-S, is a city, what is it, towards...
west,
I think. Yeah.
Like northwest. Yeah, I mean, really, that was a city of convenience. I went in somewhere not too far, somewhere he could get to easily, and somewhere I've never been, actually. I haven't been there. I've been to quite a few places in France, and usually I go somewhere when I'm going to put it in a book. That makes me think I should go there, although it's a bit late now.
Since it's out. But anyway, there's train service to Rennes. And so, you know, it just keeps cropping up somehow in the investigation.
Yeah, it does. It does. And it's one of those things where in the good old days, pre-war, it would have been real easy for him to investigate, to take off and do his job. But because of the pressures of multiple investigations and different pressures from different authority figures, it takes him a while to cotton on that Rennes is an important city in this investigation. And then when he goes there, bad things happen to him for a minute or two, but that's okay.
Kind of like Donna Leon occasionally leaves Venice to move over onto the mainland, and is never as good news when that happens for Commissario Brunetti. Right. So, you know, Paris is the main location. But in fact, France had a decent railroad system, Le Train Bleu, that went down south towards the Riviera and so forth. And today you can still, you know, probably a lot more easily now, zip around France.
It's incredible. The last time I was there, we I guess we were with the kids, and you could just, or not, it doesn't matter. The kids are irrelevant. You can just get on a train in Paris and be in London in 2 hours. And I tell people this if you're thinking of going, go first class, because it's not that much more expensive and you get a meal. I mean, you don't have to buy food on the train or when you get to the station, which is very expensive.
Hasn't Brexit slowed that down?
It didn't when we were there last. No, it was still, I mean,
I thought they were having a lot of trouble with the channel with, maybe that's just the truckers and the freight.
The French striking, probably the sheep.
Right.
Bombers.
Isn't Rennes the capital of Brittany, now that I think about it? I think it might be.
Yes. If there are no follow-up questions or nobody who knows anymore, absolutely.
I'm fairly sure. I mean, in other words, it's an important city. It's not just a small town in France, but it's actually a department capital. I have never been there either, but I really want to go to Brittany. And any of you read the Jean-Luc Banalek series, which I absolutely, if you haven't, I can't recommend it. The first one's called A Murder in Brittany. It's one of our best-selling paperback series now, new hardcover. And it's been on television, but weirdly enough, it's a German production with a Spanish guy who's playing Henri Dupin,
really?
Who is the inspector. Yeah, I have not figured that out. It's like Martin Walker. You know, Bruno is the German television series. And Donna Leon, Commissario Brunetti in Venice, was a German television series. And none of them looked Italian. It was so bizarre. Oh. They didn't dress like Italians. They didn't, you know. And so I don't know what it is then.
I'm pretty sure they won't be doing my books.
You don't think so?
Well, the Germans
are the bad guys, right?
That's why I don't have a German publisher, I think, for the Hugo books, because in the very first one, it's kind of for the Second World War.
Got it.
Flashbacks or whatever, history. Right. So I'm sure they read that and they're like, nope.
Actually, even more amusing, Monsieur Banalek is actually German, who holidays in Brittany, but he's also an executive in your publisher. But anyway, they're really wonderful, aren't they? They truly are. So Bannalec, I can't recommend them highly enough. A Murder in Brittany. it's all good if there are more French series, right? There's
more than Marius.
And in fact, Martin Walker's new book will be out. It is out. We'll be here next week, Murder in the Chateau. So Bruno has a new book. But Martin is not coming to November because the cookbook, finally we're going to get the cookbook. So they're going to send him with both the cookbook and the 16th case for Bruno. But you have to, I mean, I ordered the book now because they'll all be gone by November, not the cookbook, which publishes in November, but rather the new novel.
So what's the cookbook? Whose recipes?
It's Bruno. These are Bruno's recipes. And that cookbook has been in the works for I don't even know how long. And many of us have complained bitterly that it was only in German that we couldn't get it. But now, fortunately, it will be out. So I'm thinking we might have to do something that will involve a restaurant. Yeah, I know it. I'm going to think about how we're going to do this for Martin.
I can come back in November.
Can
I like
you do
food.
That? Yeah. All right.
I like food.
Well, no, it's not a series where the recipes are in the, you know, that they publish them in the back like a cozy series or something. But Bruno cooks, and part of the joy of the book is Bruno's out in his garden picking the fresh lettuces and shooing away the rabbits and, you know, all that, making his own wine, the whole bit. But that wasn't really going to be a big activity in 1940 Paris, is
it? No, although they were pretty good, inventive with the food that they had to get. I mean, you know, Mimi is using the black market, and I'm noticing, this wasn't on purpose, but I'm noticing that the one thing everyone's complaining about all the time is the coffee, because I think the coffee got slowly worse and worse, from, you know, stale beans to reused beans to reused beans to then just having chicory and then using shoe leather or whatever was next. And I think it's become kind of a running joke between Henri and Nicola now. It's like, well, what's the coffee made of this time?
Well, I mean, part of the point of coffee is the taste, but a lot of the point is the caffeine. So if they're using acorns and shoe leather, the whole point of the caffeine is largely obliterated.
Yeah, I suppose. I don't know how much of it is in the head. If it's a nice hot cup of something brown, maybe.
Well, the French drink a lot of what they call tisane, which are actually herbal teas of one sort or another. And I would have favored a tisane rather than really bad coffee.
I don't
coffee.
Know. Was that popular back then? I don't know. Maybe it should have been.
I think so. Although I find it so interesting that New Orleans is famous for its chicory coffee. I mean, voluntarily diluting the coffee. So I don't know why that would have been such a thing.
You know,
why it is such a thing.
My dad did that when we were younger. I remember he would have an amount of chicory in his coffee. And I don't know if it's a Swiss thing, but we used to spend a lot of time in Switzerland growing up. And I remember him doing it there. So maybe it was a thing. Back, maybe even
it
a holdover from the
thing.
Maybe a holdover, because
people got used to hickory. I mean, to chicory is a wartime deal.
That could well be. I mean, he was of that generation that it could have been a holdover.
You know, that's something that is really important when you're writing books set in the war, is how hard it was to get food and what really wretched diets people had. Do you remember Reese Bowen's book before the new one that just came out, The Paris Descent? The one before that was set, a woman was evacuated from London to a village, and the lengths that they went through, even in the country, to find anything to eat with rationing and the whole bit was just extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, the problem was always that it was, well, multiple problems. I mean, the supply lines, food coming in from the farms was purloined by the Germans, and any time there was a store with anything in it, people would know, and they'd queue, and they'd fight to get it, and so people had to get inventive. People like Mimi had to pay money. It's makes you wonder how fragile our current supply lines are. And I guess we saw it a little bit too, right? With COVID.
We saw it a lot in COVID.
Yeah, the supply
lines were extremely stretched.
Yeah. It actually doesn't take that much. So imagine a world war. It's kind of sobering.
That's part of the problem for the Ukrainians. I mean, they don't have enough to eat, and with the Black Sea blockade, and the grain, because Ukraine was the breadbasket of so much of the world, there are going to be people all over who aren't going to have enough to eat, you know, if the blockades continue. So, you know, feeding people is a major.
Yeah, and that was
always disrupted in wartime.
That was a huge part of the resentment that the French had towards the Germans. It wasn't just taking their apartments and strolling through the museums, and they would buy all the clothes and they would eat it. I mean, they called, one of the nicknames they had was Mange Tout, which is the snap pea, but it also means eat everything. Literally, is the French translation, it means eat everything. And that's they, so they called the Germans the mange tout, because they would just come in and they would eat all the food, and they had no cares.
Very true. They stayed at the Ritz and hung out with Chanel. And, absolutely. You know, meantime, the French were hiding their wine. I mean, you know, the wine caves in much of France, they were doing their... And if you read All the Light You Cannot See, which is about to be a film, you know that they evacuated much of the art from the Louvre and all and hid it. You know, of course, the British did that too. Most of it went to whales and coal mines. That's from right. The National Gallery and so forth. So we're lucky so much of it survived.
Yeah. No, absolutely, absolutely. It was, yeah, it's just, it's weird writing that time. I have some of my characters, particularly Henri, is quite flippant a lot of the time. And I sometimes have to rein it in a bit because I have to remind myself, look, some of this stuff wasn't really very funny. I mean, it was bad. It was bad. And for somebody like him who has a rich friend, maybe it wasn't that bad. But for a lot of people, it was, and it happened so quickly too. I mean, in just a matter of months, people went from living their normal lives to their kids being shipped off to some work camp in Germany and them having no food on the table.
The invasion was very rapid, and, you know, the French had a misplaced confidence in the Maginot Line, which was just a joke because the Germans just went around it. They didn't have to go through it. Sort of true of the Great Wall of China, you know. Anytime anybody, a lesson we apparently failed to learn under the last administration, anytime that you put up a wall, people just find a way around it.
Over, you know? Under, or around,
right.
It. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The thing that suffers with the wall at our border is really the life, you know, the animals more than people, because animals aren't so good at figuring out ways around it. In fact, the Aswan Dam in Egypt has had the same effect because it, you know, bifurcates the Nile, that the crocodile and the hippopotamus and other populations that used to go up and down the river can't do that now. And so it's been a real problem.
Yeah, I've never seen a hippo on a ladder. I can imagine that's difficult.
No. Right. It is crocodiles in Egypt, alligators in Florida.
Yeah.
Right? I have to try to keep that one in mind, right? They're not the same thing. Right. So anyway, what's really going on in the background, which we can't discuss, was a true thing that the Nazis were doing. So, you know.
Should we discuss it without discussing it?
We can't really discuss it without spoiling the plot. But they were up to a number of malign... Well, they called it science, but they were up to a number of really inhumane projects.
And again, it's amazing how many times I grew up in England where everyone was always obsessed with World War One, and particularly World War Two, and, you know, movies nonstop and comics and everything. And so growing up, and, you know, my family lived in a village and the plane had crashed in a nearby field, you know, so we were just inundated with World War II things, and I was fascinated with it growing up and read everything about it. And it's astounding to me that now at the age of 27, I'm still learning.
Liar.
All right, 31. I'm still learning new things. Like I read about that program just a couple years ago, and it blew my mind. I'm like, this is so unbelievable. How do I not know? There's a character who appears in The Dark Edge of Night, whose name is Virginia Hall, who I don't know if anybody's familiar with. She is a U.S. woman, and I had never heard of her until about 2 years ago, when my mother said to me, hey, you need to read this book called A Woman of No Importance. And it's about an American woman who wanted to be a diplomat, and of course she couldn't because she was a woman. She kept trying, and at some point she was from money, and so she came over to Europe and was hunting, and as you do, she shot her own foot off. But that didn't slow her down, and she ended up becoming a spy for the French, and then became essentially the most wanted person by the Nazis in France. And so she escaped on foot, literally, because she only had one, through the Pyrenees Mountains, got back to Britain, was debriefed and signed up by the SOE, I think they're called, the British spies, and then was like, okay, well, now you go back to France and be one of our spies. And this incredible human being who, until 3, 4, 5 years ago, I'd never even heard of. And I'm like, How is that possible? How is it possible that this?
Well, there were a lot of reasons. Part of it was the, you know, Secrets Act, or people, and also people really didn't talk about it. It was not a confessional time.
Yeah, that's true. And it, you know, it just, as much reading as I've done now on this, it just, you think of it as being World War II, and everyone went through World War II, but it's much clearer to me now that every single human being went through a different World War II. They each had their own one. And for some people, it was worse than others, and some it was better.
It depended on where you were. It depended on how old you were. Yeah. It depended on your economic status, on your health. But it was a world war.
Yeah,
it absolutely was.
And so, of course, it seems super obvious and kind of stupid to say that everybody had their own experience. But sometimes when you look at the movies, you sort of think of it as this monolithic experience where this battle happened and then Hitler killed himself and that was the end of it. But every single human being, no matter where, yeah, like you say, depending on where you were and what your circumstances, had an entirely different experience. And those stories are still being told.
Actually, with great frequency, there's a whole entire literary genre about World War II stories, you know, coming out. Many of them women's stories. We found out that those strong, independent women and all, they were actually there.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they weren't in command. It was Montgomery in Africa or something, but there were, women were doing really important things. And the genie didn't go back in the bottle all that easily when the war was over.
Thank heavens for that.
Yeah, it was a big advance for women, really. So it was great. Right. So, all right. So we make it. Well, you do know that Henri survives because we know that he's going to appear here in the next book, and we won't talk about anybody else. So any of you have questions that you'd like to ask?
The wine that Mimi kept serving Henry, is that a real wine you put in there or one you made up?
Chateau Petrus?
Yes.
I'll tell you what. Go to a wine store, ask for a bottle, bring it to me, and we'll try it. And then you tell me how real it is.
After you take out a small loan in order to buy it.
Yeah. It does. And in fact, in the new book, she serves him something and she apologizes because she can no longer get her hands on Petrus. And just to be clear, I've never tasted it yet myself. Maybe next lunchtime.
I'll buy you some. Right. I think it's from Bordeaux. Anyway, it's a red wine, and I think it's from the Bordeaux region. But it's a very famous vintage.
Would Parisians think of Henri as being a collaborator? That's a really good question, and it's one that I struggle with pretty much on the page in these two books, and I'm sure every book. Because yes, right, he's doing their bidding. Like a German is dead. Every over here, once German's dead, his job is to investigate murders. He tells himself, and I think he's correct, that he's never focused or troubled by or influenced by the person who's dead. Like what they did for a living, what kind of human being they were. And this is my experience as a prosecutor who's handled dozens of murder cases. You don't pick and choose, oh, this person was a scumbag, we're not going to bother prosecuting this case.
He comes across a person that's been murdered by someone who's in the resistance, or would he out that person?
You and I are going to have a quick chat after this. The question was, I don't know if they can hear the question, what if he comes across somebody who was murdered by a member of the resistance? I mean, that is a plum problem for him to have in a future book, let's put it that way. Because you're right. I mean, on the one hand, by investigating and solving, what if a really good person killed that horrible Nazi? And his position would be, that's, you know, I did my job, I'm paid to do my job, everyone knows that's my job, I'm doing my job. But if you're the family of the good person who killed the nasty Nazi, you're like, really, dude? Especially when, you know, in this time, thousands, tens of thousands of people were dying for no reason. Good people were dying for no reason. Yeah, you're out after curfew, you get shot. And Henri wouldn't get to investigate that, right? Because that's not really a murder. That's the, in the eyes of the new authorities, that's legitimate killing. So. And that's an added complication for this time, right? You don't just have the moral ambiguity of, am I collaborating by solving this murder? Henri, in this case, has the added complication of, well, if I don't, do I go pay a visit to Madame Guillotine? And so, you know, and the Germans obviously play into that self-interest or self-preservation. And this is what makes that period so fascinating to me, is what normal human beings, which is what he is. He's not a saint. He's not a bad person. It's the dilemmas that he faces that none of us have to face, or if we do, they're not certainly to that extent. Maybe that makes it more forgivable if he does something we wouldn't choose. But it's, as a writer, it's just so interesting to explore. Because it could go so many different ways.
Some 25 years ago, there was some Canadian author who wrote a really fascinating series about a French cop and a German cop who was in occupied Paris, and they had to solve crimes together. And it really was, they were very difficult to read sometimes. He was a serious overplotter. So you could be exhausted trying to read one of the books. But nonetheless, it was an amazing dilemma. And that could happen to Henri. Supposing somebody is murdered and the Germans assign an investigator, and then he is assigned, and the two of them have to work together to solve the crime.
Yeah, and Henri has gotten used to working by himself, solving these things. I mean, he has ostensibly a partner. And I mentioned him a couple of times, but there's a guy he's not interested in working. He has asthma, Albert Durand, at the beginning of the first book. He's like, I'm not going to this robbery murder scene because it's too far and I'm not walking over there. And so Henri's like, fine, I'll do it. But absolutely, I mean, I can definitely see a future book where that happens. And
I'm sure it did happen.
Oh, I'm sure. Especially the more important, the victim, right? I'm sure. Yeah, that could be another fun.
It was almost a witch hunt, and there were it actually, in many cases, went after women who had, you know, slept with or had relationships, well, you know, sexual relationships almost always, with Germans. And that was pretty brutal, but there were certainly men. But, you know, the thing is, there were a lot of people who actually weren't in the resistance who later claimed they were in the resistance or came to it very late. So it was awfully hard to know who was legitimately and who was a collaborator. Now, the lines were pretty blurry.
And that's exactly what I was going to say.
Also true in Italy, I might add. The same problem, very much, and especially in northern Italy. Huge discussion about, you know, whether somebody was just trying to save his farm or, you know, whatever it was, or whether he was an actual collaborator. And, you know, the women who were involved in it, some of whom were raped and, you know, dragged off, some of whom went voluntarily. I mean, you know, it was all, the lines are all so blurry.
Yeah, and how do you define collaborator? Is it the waiter who serves a meal to the German Nazi? I mean, well, I think that's an easy no, but where do you draw the line?
And look at Chanel. She got away with it. You know, there's no question that Chanel, you know, collaborated or, you know, hobnobbed with, dressed, all the rest of it. The Germans, somehow she got a pass, you know, all the, incredibly, I think, but she did.
Yeah, and it's those earthy questions that I like in the book I'm writing that I just finished. There is that becomes one of the questions. There is a character in there who, out of self-preservation rather than selfishness or what you would think of as certainly not moral collaboration, didn't, it was just a question of survival, does some things. And it's on the one hand, it's easy to judge from this distance, but also it's super hard because I don't know what I would do. I'm sure I'd be perfect, but I don't know what you would do.
You wrote one of your Hugo Marston books that was set down in, maybe it was the wine country, but anyway, out in the Chateau country. And these problems arose during the French Revolution. And, you know, same difficulty is what side was who on when. And, you know, if you went from somebody storming the Bastille to like Robespierre, and then suddenly Napoleon came along and it was all different, it was pretty dizzying, you know, switching sides and working out who to support.
And it's not, it's not a question of, well, it's Monday, 9 o'clock, it's time to decide which side I'm on. It's somebody shows up at your doorstep and asks you a question, and which way do you go?
It was in one of your ego. Do you remember which one?
Did you remember? Blood Promise, maybe?
I don't remember, but one of the Hugo Marstons, if you recall, he was in a chateau, not in Paris, in these questions.
Blood
but
Promise.
It was an 18th, you know, it was a problem that went all the way back to the 18th century,
yeah,
rather than contemporary.
Yeah.
History is always with you in countries there. Civilization goes back a really long time.
And that's
we're beginning to find it here with... indigenous people and so forth. Yeah. We're beginning to find that our history is a lot older than we tend to think it is.
Yeah. Yeah, that was an unintentional theme of most of the Hugo books was history never goes away.
I think is very much related to that woman's character. It may be a different name, but the idea of her being there in that setting and the other women who are in those doing those things.
Yeah, I mean, she makes an appearance in this book, okay, we'll get to it. No, and I'm going to give a bit away because I just find it. I just find it amusing. I thought it was funny at the time. It was one of those times I started writing something, and I would tickle to myself pink with it. So they're at a cafe together. Well, he's at a cafe having a coffee or whatever and relaxing, Henri. And then this woman sits down next to him, and he feels something brushing his shin. And he's like, oh. And he's getting a bit embarrassed by it. And then so he kind of does a bit of that back. And then he thinks, you know, he's onto something. And then it's only about, 20 minutes later when she adjusts her fake leg that he realizes she had no idea what she was doing. He was playing footsie with somebody who couldn't feel it. So I amuse myself sometimes.
Well, Josephine Baker, the American singer, was an active agent during Martin Walker in the Bruno books. She's not alive, but, her legacy, she had a chateau in the Dordogne. She was very active. So there were people, women who were playing big roles.
Yeah, absolutely. No, yeah, definitely. It's just fun for me to discover them because growing up, I was always told of the macho men doing all the shooting and, Inglourious Bastards type stuff, not these incredibly brave women who had way less support than the men did.
And something like only 25% of those women who were dropped from Britain dropped into France to support the resistance. Only 25% of them lived. Almost all of them died. I mean, it was just a tremendous death rate. You had to be really brave. It was almost like a suicide mission
brave and lucky to agree
to it. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And that's the other thing. One of the other things I'm exploring for the third book and to some degree for Dark Age of Night is the resistance. Which again, in TV and movies, is typically portrayed as this one force that goes around doing these various things, and then the more you read about it, the more you see that it was just this disparate groups of individuals who had totally different motivations, totally different philosophies.
It was guerrilla warfare.
It was guerrilla warfare, but it was so disorganized, especially at the beginning. And I had no idea. I didn't realize it was six people over here putting out a newsletter and nine people over there wanting to blow up trains, and they would fight with each other because they each thought the other was useless.
It was small pockets, right? And it was only gradually when the tide of war began to turn and more people, as I said, there were a lot of people who claimed to have been in resistance after the war, then, if they were at all, they were latecomers to the scene.
And that's the inverse question of who was a collaborator, right? What does it mean to resist? Is it not answering the door when a German comes knocking looking for milk? I mean, maybe. Is it a policeman refusing or doing a terrible job? Maybe to answer your question, is it a policeman who investigates the death of a Nazi and is like, no idea who did it when they do? Is that maybe he's a resistance member too, because he's not. Yes.
We're going to face this whole dilemma when the Ukraine war finally settles down, because it's going to be really difficult to sort out, you know, the roles of the various people involved in the combat, Russian, Ukrainian, and all kinds of other people.
Yeah.
In fact, Brad Thor's most recent thriller involved an American woman, a lawyer from Chicago, who went over to help the Ukrainians and in an orphanage. And then the Russians, the Wagner group, took the orphanage and took her prisoner. And that's why his hero, Scott Harbath, is sent in there to rescue her. And it goes on from there.
Yikes.
Yeah. So, but I mean, you know, that's not atypical of people to insert themselves into conflicts and, you know.
And then change the narrative afterwards.
Well, or, you know, it's like what was with the American soldier that walked into North Korea? You know, he was up for discipline and he apparently thought that he'd had a better deal in North Korea than if they say, but you know, now it's a question of, do we go get him or, you know, or do we just let the North Koreans have him? And did he have any valuable information? Probably not to trade. But I mean, what do you do about people like that?
Yeah, I don't know. Thank you for that. Thank you for another question.
You're right.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question is Henri going to come across somebody who is essentially hiding their true nature? In one of the books, I think maybe the one I just finished, he's asked to go on a raid, and he refuses to do it. He comes up with a different excuse, but he essentially refuses. And that's, you know, that was a moving target too, right? They start with, and it's the same with fascists everywhere, they start with one group and they eat through those, and then they go for the next target group, and then they keep going. And so initially it's the people who are obviously Jewish, and they take their houses and they take their property and they take them. But then they come for the people, you know, 2 years later who are not quite so obviously Jewish, but are. And so again, that's definitely an area to explore with of moral complexity, although it's not that complex from this distance. But when you have a man who's supposed to be a lawman upholding the law, how far is he going to push that to maybe protect somebody who he is not supposed to protect? It's fascinating.
In a later age to make decisions or make ideas about that, but I'm not the person who's making those life or death decisions in that moment in time.
Yeah, and what I'm seeing, and again, I hate to keep referencing to the book I just wrote, but because it's fresh in my mind, I guess I'm gonna. What becomes very apparent is that if you can have a brave moral stance and you can say, no, I put my foot down, I'm not doing that, and then the Nazis will come and they will torture your best friend or your wife or your child. And so you're right, it's life or death, but it's not just for you. There becomes a situation where Henri has to make a decision that, you know, he knows if it goes the wrong way, pretty much everybody in his building is done for.
It's all a village in France, the name of which I can't remember, which I have been to, where that happened, and the Nazis actually destroyed the entire village, killed everybody in it.
Yeah, and so, you know, you mentioned before about the retaliation thing. I mean, it was something
that happened in Czechoslovakia when Heinrich was assassinated. Yeah. You know, they did that. So but you know, there's an additional complication in regard to the Jewish issue, which is there was a very strong streak of anti-Semitism in the French. And if you read Carol Black's book, for example, Murder in the Marais, you read a lot of French people turned in their own fellow citizens because they were greedy to get their property or their, you know, their money or whatever it is. So it wasn't always, I mean, the Nazis were, you know, there to execute it, but it wasn't always the Nazis that, you know, preyed upon them. It was the French who then turned them over to the Nazis. So it was a really miserable era.
No, it was. And again, with the book I just finished, I should have. I do have it. It's at the hotel, actually, and I'm editing. But that's exactly what one of the main plot lines is. They were called corbeau, which is the French word for a crow, but they were poison pen letters that French people would send to the authorities saying, oh, my neighbor is using the black market or whatever it is. And they would do it just because they wanted to take that neighbor's apartment or because 2 years earlier that neighbor's kids had broken a window and they refused to pay for it.
It was a grudge thing or a greed thing or a lot that went on. But I mean, you know, if you know your French history, you could go back to the Dreyfus affair. And, you know, there's been a real problem. And the Spanish were much more tolerant, aside from the Inquisition. But, you know, they were more blended with, you know, the French have always been difficult.
And still remain that way, but they are wonderful.
Just are, right. Hi, any of you watching? Adios, Frances. Here we go. Right. Well, I think we've probably tortured you enough here with all this. Does anybody have a final killer question they would like to ask? No? Oh, yes.
The restaurant that they'd like to go to, they put the Jewish star in the window and they weren't Jewish. And why did they went ahead and put it up when they hadn't been told they had to? I seem to remember that.
Next time I come, I want a warning that nobody's to ask me about facts or plot points or characters.
Well, you could have reread the book on the plane.
You know what? Here's what I'm going to say. There was an extremely good reason for that.
That's the prosecutor. I love it. Who's now a defense attorney and learning a whole new deal. Right. So thank you, Mark. It's really been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for coming this afternoon.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Thank you, virtual audience, for joining us. And we do have copies of The Dark Edge of Night and Die Around Sundown that Mark will be signing here momentarily. So bye, everybody. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.